I bet you didn't think I was going to come on. Well, I was queuing up something and I couldn't find it, so it took me a little longer. How you doing? This is Glenn Coble, and you're listening to On the Air, and we are on the air. And today, we're going to kind of float around doing different things. I've got, as you know, I've read speeches, I've played speeches. This is an educational station, and I'm trying to keep that going a little bit. And by giving you great speeches by dignitaries of all sizes and all ilks and all sorts of stuff, everything from Sojourn, what's Sojourn's last name? I forgot. Anyway, from soup to nuts, right? And we have today, the very first one I'm going to have is one by Eisenhower. It's basically Eisenhower's farewell speech, for a lack of a better explanation. It's the one that a lot of people tie together with his warnings about the industrial military complex. My father and mother and grandfather and grandmother were devout Republicans, and Eisenhower was kind of a centrist Republican, really appealing to my father, who was a kind of a centrist Republican and a very very involved in public affairs and very involved in racist things, where he was he marched in the Selma to Montgomery march. He was very involved in civil rights, and so when President Eisenhower came to, he wasn't a president at the time, I don't believe. I think he was stumping to become president. But he came to South Bend, Indiana, and we lived in South Bend. My father was a minister at St. Paul's Methodist Church there in South Bend. And my mother and father got a little involved in the publicity. Dad always felt it was wrong that religious people should be in politics, and he was not in politics, but he wanted to go see Eisenhower march down Lincoln Way, ride down Lincoln Way in his entourage, and so we went down that way, and one of my father's parishioners saw us there and asked if I would walk down Lincoln Way with her and hand out I Like Ike buttons. And she was a very good friend of the family. So and back then people didn't worry so much about letting their little boy, who was probably 5 or 6 years old, walk with somebody that is not a member of the family. But anyway, I'm trying to remember her name. She was my father's secretary. But anyway, she asked if I could go along. She thought people would be more receptive to taking a button from a 5-year-old than an older woman. So I walked with her, and we handed out buttons. So that was my very first politics, trying to help a Republican, Dwight D. Eisenhower, become president of the United States. And it was really a joy for me. I really don't remember much of it, because basically I was holding her hand and carrying a little box full of buttons, and she'd hand people the button. Or I guess I did hand some of them. I don't remember very well. But we had a good time that day, and that's my very first memory of anything having to do with politics. I really didn't know, obviously, at that age, I didn't know what it meant. I was just a cute little face. And I don't know if you've ever seen pictures of me. I post all sorts of different pictures of me as an advertisement for my show on Wednesday, A Progressive Life. And I try to post different pictures. You know, when I was 5 years old, I posted pictures of that. I've posted pictures of what I look like currently. I posted pictures of when I was married, when I played football, when I signed into the Army field band, all sorts of things like that. Just, you know, keep it interesting. I want you people to listen to our shows. And so that's my first political thing, and I didn't realize what Dwight D. Eisenhower stood for as far as politics went back then. But since then, I was, like I've told a lot of people on my Wednesday show, I was a Republican till Nixon. Now, Nixon came along right after I was able to vote, so I did vote for him the first time, I think. But anyway, Eisenhower was the type of Republican that my family believed in. Now, my father, or my grandfather, absolutely hated Roosevelt. Now, my grandfather was a very well-to-do doctor, and he didn't like the attitude, the money type thing. He didn't like where he really would have gone along with people today saying that Franklin Delano Roosevelt was a socialist, not a communist. He wouldn't have gone that far, but because I do remember Grandpa not liking McCarthy, you would have thought in his ilk he would have liked McCarthy, but he did not like McCarthy. He thought McCarthy was making stuff up. But anyway, Grandpa Coble did not like President Roosevelt. Now, I kind of got in trouble here. My phone went crazy, so I'm trying to do two things at one time. And at my age, it isn't as easy as it used to be, and especially with technology, it's kind of. Kind of strange, but anyway, I got what I needed to do. So we're going to listen to Eisenhower's farewell speech, and listen carefully to where... Oh, hello? People talking to me in my left ear, and there's nobody here to talk to me. But anyway, listen to his positions. You will be surprised that he was a Republican, considering the way the Republicans are now. He's far more centrist. He's very forgiving, very kind-sounding. And I'm not saying there aren't kind Republicans. Of course there are. But he's far less... he's more thoughtful now than we seem to be now. And I think you'll enjoy listening. Listen closely to the words, what he says. He had been the five-star general commanding all of our armies in World War II. So you would think he would be kind of a warlike person. But I think if you listen to his words, you'll find that he was very thoughtful about his position and what we should do and how we should be as open as possible to what was going on. It's about, I don't know, 16-17 minute speech. If you want to, I'm going to start it here in about 2 minutes, and we will listen to President Dwight D. Eisenhower's farewell address. And I think you will find it's quite interesting to listen to the full speech. Let's see, it says it lasts 15 minutes and 45 seconds, so that's not too bad. And I think you will be pleasantly surprised. Some of you may think he's a little bit too far to the left, but he was quite an interesting president. I think I'm going to have to ask Fred Malone when he comes on next time where he would rank as far as, or I could ask Dr. Feynman where he would rank as far as presidents go. I'm sure it's in the top half, if not the top 10%, or top 10. Now you do understand his vice president was Richard Milhouse Nixon. And by the way, Milhouse is a family name of my family. We're related, but very far apart. All right, let me see if I can get this thing to work and so that you can listen to it. And when it's over, we'll get back on and we'll talk about some of the things he said. And if you'd like to call in afterwards, we have a free line, 740-383-9944. We're also going to do Roosevelt's speech. Talking about we have nothing to fear but fear itself. And then I'm going to do, at the end, I'm going to do a speech that was given in a movie by Charlie Chaplin, and it's called The Dictator's Speech. Now, I've done it once before, but I think it's worth listening to. It kind of is where I stand politically now. And it's a speech that really strikes home for me. So I thought I'd play that. We may have time for one more. I'm not sure. But if we do, I'll let you know before we start it. All right, let's see if I can get to this speech. We'll listen to it. I've got to be careful because they're going to talk to me about toe fungus, and I'm not sure I want to talk about toe fungus.
First, I should like to express my gratitude to the radio and television networks for the opportunities they have given me over the years to bring reports and messages to our nation. My special thanks go to them for the opportunity of addressing you this evening. 3 days from now, after half a century in the service of our country, I shall lay down the responsibilities of office as, in traditional and solemn ceremony, the authority of the presidency is vested in my successor. This evening, I come to you with a message of leave-taking and farewell, and to share a few final thoughts with you, my countrymen. Like every other citizen, I wish the new president and all who will labor with him Godspeed. I pray that the coming years will be blessed with peace and prosperity for all. Our people expect their president and the Congress to find essential agreement on issues of great moment, the wise resolution of which will better shape the future of the nation. My own relations with the Congress, which began on a remote and tenuous basis when, long ago, a member of the Senate appointed me to West Point, have since ranged to the intimate during the war and immediate post-war period, and finally to the mutually interdependent during these past 8 years. In this final relationship, the Congress and the administration have, on most vital issues, cooperated well. To serve the nation good rather than mere partisanship, and so have assured that the business of the nation should go forward. So my official relationship with the Congress ends in a feeling, on my part, of gratitude that we have been able to do so much together. We now stand 10 years past the midpoint of a century that has witnessed 4 major wars among great nations. 3 of these involved our own country. Despite these holocausts, America is today the strongest, the most influential, and most productive nation in the world. Understandably proud of this preeminence, we yet realize that America's leadership and prestige depend not merely upon our unmatched material progress, riches, and military strength, but on how we use our power in the interest of world peace and human betterment. Throughout America's adventure in free government, our basic purposes have been to keep the peace, to foster progress in human achievement, and to enhance liberty, dignity, and integrity among peoples and among nations. To strive for less would be unworthy of a free and religious people. Any failure traceable to arrogance or our lack of comprehension or readiness to sacrifice would inflict upon us grievous hurt, both at home and abroad. Progress toward these noble goals is persistently threatened by the conflict now engulfing the world. It commands our whole attention, absorbs our very beings. We face a hostile ideology, global in scope, atheistic in character, ruthless in purpose, and insidious in method. Unhappily, the danger it poses promises to be of indefinite duration. To meet it successfully, there is call for not so much the emotional and transitory sacrifices of crisis, but rather those which enable us to carry forward steadily, surely, and without complaint, the burdens of a prolonged and complex struggle with liberty the stake. Only thus shall we remain, despite every provocation, on our charted course toward permanent peace and human betterment. Crises there will continue to be. In meeting them, whether foreign or domestic, great or small, there is a recurring temptation to feel that some spectacular and costly action could become the miraculous solution to all current difficulties. A huge increase in newer elements of our defenses. Development of unrealistic programs to cure every ill in agriculture. A dramatic expansion in basic and applied research. These and many other possibilities, each possibly promising in itself, may be suggested as the only way to the road we wish to travel. But each proposal must be weighed in the light of a broader consideration, the need to maintain balance in and among national programs. Balance between the private and the public economy. Balance between the cost and hoped for advantages. Balance between the clearly necessary and the comfortably desirable. Balance between our essential requirements as a nation and the duties imposed by the nation upon the individual. Balance between actions of the moment and the national welfare of the future. Good judgment seeks balance in progress. Lack of it eventually finds imbalance and frustration. The record of many decades stands as proof that our people and their government have, in the main, understood these truths and have responded to them well in the face of threat and stress. But threats, new in kind or degree, constantly arise. Of these, I mention two only. A vital element in keeping the peace is our military establishment. Our arms must be mighty, ready for instant action, so that no potential aggressor may be tempted to risk his own destruction. Our military organization today bears little relation to that known of any of my predecessors in peacetime, or indeed by the fighting men of World War II or Korea. Until the latest of our world conflicts, the United States had no armaments industry. American makers of plowshares could, with time and as required, make swords as well. But we can no longer risk emergency improvisation of national defense. We have been compelled to create a permanent armaments industry of vast proportions. Added to this, 3.5 million men and women are directly engaged in the defense establishment.
If you want to know why you're so tired so often, look at
Well, naturally, we go to an ad, so I have to go back, and I have to change that. So we will be doing that, and then we will get back to President Eisenhower's farewell speech.
Security alone, more than the net income of all United States corporations. Now, this conjunction of an immense military establishment and a large arms industry is new in the American experience. The total influence, economic, political, even spiritual, is felt in every city, every state house, every office of the federal government. We recognize the imperative need for this development, yet we must not fail to comprehend its grave implications. Our toil, resources, and livelihood are all involved. So is the very structure of our society. In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes. We should take nothing for granted. Only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry can compel the proper meshing of the huge industrial and military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals, so that security and liberty may prosper together. Akin to and largely responsible for the sweeping changes in our industrial military posture has been the technological revolution during recent decades. In this revolution, research has become central. It also becomes more formalized, complex, and costly. A steadily increasing share is conducted for, by, or at the direction of the federal government. Today, the solitary inventor, tinkering in his shop, has been overshadowed by task forces of scientists in laboratories and testing fields. In the same fashion, the free university, historically the fountainhead of free ideas and scientific discovery, has experienced a revolution in the conduct of research. Partly because of the huge costs involved, a government contract becomes virtually a substitute for intellectual curiosity. For every old blackboard, there are now hundreds of new electronic computers. The prospect of domination of the nation's scholars by federal employment, project allocations, and the power of money is ever present and is gravely to be regarded. Yet in holding scientific research and discovery in respect, as we should, we must also be alert to the equal and opposite danger that public policy could itself become the captive of a scientific, technological elite. It is the task of statesmanship to mold, to balance, and to integrate these and other forces, new and old, within the principles of our democratic system, ever aiming toward the supreme goals of our free society. Another factor in maintaining balance involves the element of time. As we peer into society's future, we, you and I, and our government, must avoid the impulse to live only for today, plundering for our own ease and convenience the precious resources of tomorrow. We cannot mortgage the material assets of our grandchildren without risking the loss also of their political and spiritual heritage. We want democracy to survive for all generations to come, not to become the insolvent phantom of tomorrow. During the long lane of the history yet to be written, America knows that this world of ours, ever growing smaller, must avoid becoming a community of dreadful fear and hate, and be instead a proud confederation of mutual trust and respect. Such a confederation must be one of equals. The weakest must come to the conference table with the same confidence as do we, protected as we are by our moral, economic, and military strength.
That table, though scarred by many past frustrations, cannot be abandoned for the certain agony of the battlefield. Disarmament with mutual honor and confidence is a continuing imperative. Together we must learn how to compose differences, not with arms, but with intellect and decent purpose. Because this need is so sharp and apparent, I confess that I lay down my official responsibilities in this field with a definite sense of disappointment. As one who has witnessed the horror and the lingering sadness of war, as one who knows that another war could utterly destroy this civilization, which has been so slowly and painfully built over thousands of years, I wish I could say tonight that a lasting peace is in sight. Happily, I can say that war has been avoided. Steady progress toward our ultimate goal has been made, but so much remains to be done. As a private citizen, I shall never cease to do what little I can to help the world advance along that road. So in this, my last good night to you as your president, I thank you for the many opportunities you have given me for public service in war and in peace. I trust in that service, you find some things worthy. As for the rest of it, I know you will find ways to improve performance in the future. You and I, my fellow citizens, need to be strong in our faith that all nations under God will reach the goal of peace with justice. May we be ever unswerving in devotion to principle, confident but humble with power, diligent in pursuit of the nation's great goals. To all the peoples of the world, I once more give expression to America's prayerful and continuing aspiration. We pray that peoples of all faiths, all races, all nations, may have their great human needs satisfied, that those now denied opportunity shall come to enjoy it to the full, that all who yearn for freedom may experience its spiritual blessings. Those who have freedom will understand also its heavy responsibility, that all who are insensitive to the needs of others will learn charity, and that the sources, scourges of poverty, disease, and ignorance will be made disappear from the earth, and that in the goodness of time, all peoples will come to live together in a peace guaranteed by the binding force of mutual respect and love. Now, on Friday noon, I am to become a private citizen. I am proud to do so. I look forward to it. Thank you and good night.
Well, that was Dwight Eisenhower as his farewell address to the public back in the early 50s when he was ending his presidency. Now, can you see why it's a speech that a person like me, a progressive person, really appreciates? He calls, and most of my listeners know that I'm an atheist, but he calls for a prayerful thought, and I have absolutely nothing against any religion. He calls for all religions to be respected, and I think that's an absolute must, and we've seemed to have lost that. He calls for a peaceful changeover from one administration to another. We seem to have put that on the back burner. He calls for us to be vigilant about our military industrial complex, which has kind of taken a second to, it's kind of been pushed back. We spend more money right now on our military complex than 45 other nations combined. and way more than whoever's in second place, which I'm guessing is probably China. It may be the Soviet Union. They're not Soviet Union anymore, but we spend a lot of money on that, and it has become immense in its power to demand demand us to listen to the industrial complex. The thoughts that he has about giving all of us, whether we're a Hindu or a Methodist or a Catholic, giving us all the rights that all people should have. He goes back to, in essence, the Declaration of Independence, which probably didn't imply this, but that all men are created equal. Now, we all know that early in our history, African Americans were not created equal. They were basically treated like animals. Even after a while, they were only considered three-fifths of a white person. But he seems to imply that all of us should respect all of us. And that was one of the things that I liked about Dwight Eisenhower. He did seem to have empathy, which we have lost. Or not all of our politicians have lost it, but a large portion of our politicians. He also calls upon honesty clear thought, which we have definitely lost. The honesty has gone out the window. Now, there are honest politicians. When I was running for state representative, I can't tell you how many people came up to me and say, all politicians are rotten. Well, that's not true. And I would ask them, do you know anything about me? And most of them knew nothing about me. That was probably one of my biggest faults, is that I didn't let enough people know about me. But not all politicians are rotten. I got to meet several politicians who were wonderful people, cared about their fellow citizens, and were in it to improve American civilization. Sometimes it's hard to call it a civilization the way we're acting lately. Anyway, there are a lot of honest politicians. Now, some of the politicians have learned to play games with the rules. To those I say, back off and try to help the country, not yourself. And we just don't know how to do that. I think, had I been elected, I would have been out in a woods with a lot of people who do not treat other people that way. I think there are still good politicians, good people, people that think about things, people that I absolutely disagree with, like Mitt Romney or Liz Cheney there are a lot of people that I disagree with, but they think through things. They try to see what would be best for the country, best for all of our citizens. That's what I'm looking for. If I were going to the polls tomorrow, or to the elections tomorrow, I would have a hard time finding a lot of people like that on the right side of the ballot. I don't know why it's become that way, and hopefully it will adjust itself, as most of our history has done throughout our 70 some years, whatever it is, we have learned to adjust to whatever comes our way. We're not adjusting real well right now, and so therefore, that's one of the reasons why I played that. I really think that we need to listen to some of our previous elected officials, from a time when elected officials talked to each other, from a time when elected officials thought it was a matter of honor to be honest with each other. You can be honest and absolutely disagree with each other. But right now, if we can't say we disagree with you, we find a lie to tell that bolsters our position. And I think we need to find a way to get around that. Anyway, in the next 45 minutes period, I'm going to play Franklin Delano Roosevelt's speech about we have nothing to fear but fear itself. And that's one of the problems that I see we're delving into. We're so afraid. Somebody's going to get something that I don't have, which I find, well, a lot of my friends are good Christian people. And one of the tenets of being a Christian is thou shalt not covet. And what we seem to be doing is pointing fingers at somebody who's getting, you know, something from the government that I'm not getting and saying that that's wrong. Ignore what somebody else is getting from the government and do, as President Kennedy would say, do for this country what you would have it do for you. You know, I mean, that's not even close to what he said, but I truly believe we need to find a way to say to our neighbors who we absolutely disagree with, I disagree with you, but I'll help you move forward. And we just don't seem to have that in our hearts right now. But the FDR speech that you'll hear is talking about having courage. And it's during a wartime, so there was more courage needed than right now. However, we do need a lot of courage right now. One of the things in Eisenhower's speech that he really asks us to do is to defend our democracy. And one of the things we're really struggling to do is to defend our democracy. I don't understand that at all. Maybe it was the way I was brought up, or maybe it's I'm not smart enough, but I don't understand why people don't want to defend our democracy. We scream freedom, but freedom is something that we should all enjoy with each other, not my freedom to be over you, not my freedom despite your lack of freedom. My freedom is no better than my next-door neighbor's freedom. If my next-door neighbor is put into jail because he happens to be an African-American, or she's gay or whatever, my freedom is stolen at that point. And my freedom means less if other people around me do not have the same freedoms. And that's something I think we need to truly think about as we move forward. And that's why my show on Wednesday is called A Progressive Life, is because I truly believe all of us want to move forward, don't we? I can't imagine wanting to move back. You know, we can always move back a year and all die of COVID. As a matter of fact, there are several people in the United States that seem to not care about that. And it's kind of interesting to hear people who have interviewed people that are dying from COVID say, I wish I had gotten the shot. I have a real hard time having sympathy for people that say, I wish I had gotten the shot. I have a loved member of my family who has not gotten the shot. And yesterday I asked, have you gotten the shot? And she had, but part of her family had not. So I'm going to find it very horrible if one of my family members comes down with COVID. Hopefully it will be minor, but you never know. Do your part. It doesn't hurt. I really think there are a lot of people that are just chickens. They're afraid of getting a shot. It doesn't hurt. It will do you a world of good. It'll give you a lot of peace. After I got my second shot and I knew that I was 2 weeks out, I really felt free. Now, the other day I put my mask on when I went into a crowded area because of this new virus strain that's come out. And I had people look at me like I was an idiot. Well, maybe I'm not an idiot. I don't know. Do the best you can to help your neighbors. We'll get back. We'll talk. We'll have FDR's speech, and we'll also have Charlie Chaplin's speech. And I'm trying to educate and help you have an enjoyable morning. We'll be right back.
You're listening to WWGH Radio 107.1 FM, your